Now, think how torturous the last hour was. You know, going through what is it that Franz is thinking, and what is it that Dublin is thinking, and what is it that Dr. Dennis is trying to do with this, and you know, it's really getting fuzzy here, right? But that's the way it felt as the Weimar was falling apart. I mean, think about, you know, all the options out there, so many different voices yelling and screaming about what things should be. You know, ostensibly a very progressive democratic system in place, but there are no clear answers to this. Okay, and then it completely collapses after 1929, and where you had maybe 10 or 15% unemployment, it goes to 30, 40% in various regions, right? And gets worse than what's described in Berlin Alexanderplatz. But then, this party that had not had significant representation, receiving, we can look at the statistics, 100,000 votes in elections in 1928, 1929. Right? But they're perceived as providing some sort of clear answers, identifying very specific causes and directed, simplified, comprehensible prescriptions for dealing with those problems. Now, I was just talking to Dr. Buchholz. You're all too young, probably, to remember Ross Perot. Okay, but for a while, this guy was coming out of Texas with this language, this Southern accent, practical, let's put our heads under the hood and figure this out. Right? I'm not going to tell you exactly what I'm going to do, but I can tell you that I can look under the hood and figure out what it's going to be, and we're going to go this. And it was very attractive at the time. And let me just also throw this out here, because Dr. Buchholz and I were playing with it too. Now, it's coming from a completely different perspective. But just think about what you're hearing now. You're hearing, you know, people who've been involved with the politics of the United States over the last 15, 20 years, McCain and Clinton, obviously different, but they're awash in policy, okay? They're providing details. Right? But then there's this voice over here saying, you know, hope, togetherness. Now, I've looked at the website, and I don't, you know, there's plenty of specifics behind all this. But what Obama's been accused of is just providing this sort of rhetoric that provides you with a feeling of progress and something can be cleaner and clearer and move to a higher plane and so on. And, of course, he's being chided by Clinton for doing that. But the effect that that does have, I mean, it is working at the rallies. That's his stump speech. They all have stump speeches. Reagan was elected on a speech that he just gave over and over and over and over again back in those days. So that's nothing new. They're just... when you can't find anything else to nail him with, you nail him with that. But that stump speech is very powerful because it provides this sort of this imagery that is uplifting and enlightening and provides a sort of a clear beacon. Right? So, you know, not talking about the specifics of it, but if that voice starts to show up in a period of disorder of confusion and relative chaos, right? Not that our situation is that bad, but it's pretty bad, right? People hearken to it, right? They turn to it for its own sake. And from my perspective, I just say, thank goodness there isn't a right-wing Barack Obama out there. Because it very well could be. Right? It very well could be if someone came in with that kind of a voice and that kind of anger. I would be... Others might be happy about that, but it very well could be a right-wing voice that was coming in with it. Right? So that's a way to get you set up for that feeling that people had, and it was never a majority, but a significant minority, when this outsider, right, who hasn't been involved with the ins and outs of Weimar Republican politics, comes in with a perspective, an extreme perspective, but most importantly, a stump speech, if you will, right, and a whole culture that seemed to provide clear answers to complicated questions, that seemed to provide a straightforward prescription. Now, the problem is you have to take the pill. And the pill is that there's pretty much one cause for all of the problems. You figure out what that is, right? But it could be anything, but in this case, the Jewish problem is the source of all of these problems. And if you take that pill, it clarifies all the problems that Franz is up against and all the problems that Dipline is working with. And then suddenly things seem to be quite clear. And in that environment, this is the impact that the culture of National Socialism had. And although they were also, you know, policy oriented and had answers for each of the issues that were going on, it was the clarity with which they presented them. And I'll run through this in a minute, but Hitler felt that his greatest achievement in the first days, and really overall as a politician, was to take what was a very complicated and convoluted party platform of this small tool and die workers party that he joined and became influential within, and reduced it to 25 clear points. Okay, and those 25 points remained the basis for his whole political program. So it's that simplification of things, right, and articulation of things in a very direct way that he's very aware of as a potent political method. To the point where, as we're going to see, and if you don't know already, he's extremely direct about the power of focusing attention on a single adversary. Where there are multiple problems, blame them on a single adversary. Then things will be clear and people will be able to understand them. Don't get involved with complicated explanations of what you're doing. Get things down to very simple slogans and hammer at those slogans over and over and over again. Don't try to construct arguments that take into account the positions of others. That's just going to confuse you and confuse your listeners. Just take whatever information is necessary and supports your position, emphasize that, and hammer away at your policy or your argument. And he actually articulates that here, but others may have put it even more succinctly. The big lie. If you stand by the big lie, if you hold to it, and if you are consistent in that, and never relinquish, people will become convinced of it. You just have to say it enough, and it becomes true. Hitler is very articulate about that in Mein Kampf. He knows that that's what the power of that, which he says he learned from war propaganda, wartime propaganda. Is the basis for his success and what the party needs to continue to do after its failure in 1923 in the Beer Hall Putsch. And I think that the reading of Dublin, besides just giving you this feel for the modernism of the Weimar era and modernist efforts to capture that and then what it was like on the streets, but that sense of confusion, disorientation, and frustration, it's a really excellent way to set you up for the feeling that this new movement provided. Now, the other thing I want to say by way of transition is that to a certain degree, I want you to deal and think of Hitler as another emblematic individual. We dealt with Dietrich Hessling. We dealt with Paul, and we've dealt with Franz. And Hitler, of course, is our primary case in trying to get a feel for the culture and ideas and the environment of National Socialism. To a certain degree, I think you can see elements of all three of our previous figures in Hitler. So by reading about Dietrich, by reading about Paul, and by reading about Franz, I think that was all a way of preparing you for Hitler. He doesn't come out of the blue. He's not hatched, he's born. And he's born into this environment. And each of the elements that we've studied are at play. He's certainly sort of a loner who's raised in this environment of German nationalism in Austria, right, and is influenced by pan-Germanic political culture early, and he tells us that. And you know, he's got the father who beats him, and he's someone who's looking for an identity, just as Dietrich was. And he attaches himself to military history and nationalist politics. Before he's ever even heard of a Jew, he's already thinking that way. Okay. Then, of course, he goes to the war. So he is a Paul. He is there. He is in the trenches, as we said. And all the elements that we try to gather, both in a positive way and in a negative way, had their influence on Hitler's development. Right? And in between those two stages, he was on the streets in Vienna, just like Franz, and had a lot of the same kind of experiences and walked away with some of the same kind of attitudes. We need order. We need order. We need to structure this. This is a mess. And that wasn't Weimar-era Vienna. It was pre-war Vienna, but many of his anti-urban attitudes are derived from that experience. So he was down and out and living in homeless shelters, with Franz's, if not embodying a kind of Franz type himself. Now, the other thing that I want to insist upon from the start is that we really must take Hitler as a real person. And that's why we're going to look at words that he actually penned. Now, there's a lot of myth-making going on in his construction of this autobiography. We have to pay attention to some of that. But we do have to recognize that Hitler was not some sort of a magical creature who was capable of mesmerizing and brainwashing and hypnotizing masses of people. He was really a very average German, and the components that went into his makeup were very common in the time, in the sense that they overlap with what Dietrich went with or came from, and with what Paul went with, and with what Franz went with. Those are all very common. He was very much every man in Germany. Now, what he did, and the way he was able to manipulate that and to present it in a way that was so propagandistically efficient and effective, that's unique. But the elements that went into him were quite common at that time, and I don't think it in any way is disrespectful of the victims of National Socialism to deal with Hitler and his followers as very specific and real human beings. It's an error to transform them into some sort of monstrous, bestial, superhuman creatures as a way of essentially deflecting the human responsibility. We need to empathize with Hitler in order to understand the phenomenon. Right? Because many people went through similar things, and that's why he was so successful. That he was able to communicate with them. Because he shared that. Now, just a little scan up to more or less when the book is being written, and just to give you some of the background. As he tells us, he was born in a small town in Austria. Okay, and that's important. Hitler is not German. I mean, not from the German nation. He's not a political German. He's from Austria. And therefore, he is motivated by this pan-German desire to unify. And here's where that whole issue of putting together the small German option versus the large German option that Bismarck brought about, becomes pivotal. He's exemplary of that whole vision of a larger Germany and bringing that together. And he tells us in the first pages that this is what he was inspired to do from his earliest days. Now that may be myth-making, but it's not inconsistent with attitudes among certain Germans and German-speaking people in Austria. We need to be unified. So that's a given. He's going to search for a larger German option. And politically, that's what the whole National Socialist program is all about. We're going to put together all these diverse territories that should be German and should have been German all along, and then we're going to enslave other territories to pay for that and to have the resources and have the manpower in order to keep this state that deserves to be unified in a total way. Right? So all those issues of the 19th century are still there. They're still on the table, and that's the geopolitical vision of Hitler. Right? It's all designed to make Germany whole and make it function as that totality. Just a few things here. They're not a poor family. His father's a sort of an average bureaucrat. He's is it postal or is it? I can't remember. I should look that up real quick. I've just lost the term for it. I have it. This is what his father does. It doesn't matter that much. But his father was a customs. That's what I meant. Customs officer. So relatively comfortable. Now Hitler's going to have his down and out days, but he's never going to be absolutely destitute. He's not going to be Franz completely. But he constructs a myth of himself as having been absolutely down and out and destitute. So it's the hard luck story. Now there are these rumors which were circulating during the Nazi era, something that Hitler had to deal with himself, and you know, you can take this as far as you want, but his father was the illegitimate son of a woman who had worked as a housekeeper for a Jewish family that had sons. Just so you know, that's where that rumor comes from. Okay, so there's this hypothetical possibility that Hitler was a quarter Jewish, but there's no proof of it at all. But these rumors were circulating at the time, and it is true that when they did take over in the Anschluss, Austria, the church, which held the family records, which would have proven things one way or the other, might have, was used as target practice for artillery purposes, and those records were destroyed. So, end of that problem. But it was, you know, it was a sort of a backroom joke, but something that you certainly wouldn't want anybody to find you talking about during the Nazi era. But that said, I mean, we'll get into the weirdness of this as we move along. It is not inconsistent in any way with the National Socialist's anti-Semitic worldview that Hitler himself would have been infected by Jewish blood. That's the point. Right? I think there's this tendency among people who play with that idea to think, we're going to prove that Hitler was wrong. As if we need to prove that Hitler was wrong, right? I mean, it's all rational anyway. But actually it's not, because the whole point of the anti-Semitic racial perspective is that the German cultural, political, and racial body has been infected. Okay? It's been infected. Now drastic measures are necessary to overcome that, including self-destruction. This is the nihilist element of the whole Nazi view. Marching, and this to a certain degree can be associated with the whole decision to unleash an almost impossible military plan, right? But even more importantly, the last days, where he calls for a scorched earth policy and wants, you know, all the German industry to be destroyed and blown up, and all the rivers to be poisoned, and all the lakes to be poisoned, and you know, all the things that Speer is running around trying to stop in the last days of the war, get people not to follow those orders. people say, I mean, it's a sign of his madness, right? But it's actually consistent with his view. If the German people aren't able to cure themselves by following Nazi policy and by winning the war, then the only answer for them is self-destruction, is self-extermination. The German people does not deserve to live on if it's unable to do this, because it's been undermined from within. So it's not it's not inconsistent that he himself was manifestation of this and ends up destroying himself as well. We must die, that something fresher will come afterward, or this is just the end point. Right? That's mad, but it's consistent within the framework. If you've taken the pill, this makes sense right up to the end. So that back to that. That's sort of the tangent that leads away from the question of what Hitler's heritage was. I myself have represented this problem. Right. And that's why also, if you say, well, wait a minute, you guys don't look Aryan. Himmler? Goebbels? Hitler? Goering? Well, maybe Goering, but he got so fat. Okay? Right? They're not Aryan. So you go, well, you know, obviously you're wrong, because you don't look like what you say we're all supposed to look like. But see, that's the point. We don't. But we must do this, that the next phase does. So, those are some of the key elements from the earliest days. Now, after his father dies, and he lives with his mother for a couple of years, and you know, the record is that things were a little bit more like Dietrich's father, but he doesn't really go that into Mein Kampf. He cleans that up a little bit. But through all of this, two fascinations are developing that are key. One is with Wagner's operas. Lohengrin is the opera that he mentions as being the first that he's influenced by, but then another one named Rienzi, we have record of him elsewhere being overwhelmed by that opera. And then the desire to go to art school to study architecture. And this obsession with traditional looking, neo-romantic and neoclassical official buildings. This is the art that he loves. And when he does go to Vienna, he has one good thing to say, and that's that he loves these neo-Gothic, neo-romantic, neoclassical buildings that have been built on the Ringstrasse in the previous century. He thinks those are the greatest, and those are the models for his aesthetic view. And his dream is to go to Vienna and then go to the school and study architecture. Well, he is I'll flash this up next time, but he is a proficient copier of artistic form, of architectural form. He's very good at doing drawings and watercolors of buildings. And clearly he trained himself to do that. He was self-taught. He didn't go to some sort of a preparatory art school. So he brought a portfolio of that to Vienna, and he tried at least twice to get into art school on the basis of that portfolio. But he was rejected because he didn't have classical training in figurative drawing. They said, this stuff's okay, and I've met an Israeli scholar who went around to all the art schools in Europe and just submitted these images without telling them who had done them and asked, would you accept somebody on the basis of this evidence? And they would say, yeah, we would accept him now, because you don't have that classical requirement anymore. Right? She wrote a paper on that. But at that time, you know, he just couldn't get over that hurdle, and he was rejected, which was absolutely devastating to him. And the result was that he attempted to make a living by selling his drawings. So when he's down and out on the streets in Vienna, what he's doing is doing these watercolor paintings, and he's selling them to the tourist crowd. And people, there are records of him, that he lived in the equivalent of the YMCA, and he had this table in the common area where he kept his paints and so on, and nobody, and his books, and nobody bothered his stuff. And he did his painting there, and he actually had a partner who would go out and sell them, and sometimes he was out there, and people remember seeing him. He was a fixture, both in Vienna and in Munich, in the tourist area. So if you if you were downtown and people were doing these watercolor paintings, you might have recognized him, right? I think maybe one or two people remember, or claim they remember seeing him. So that's what he was doing. That's what he was doing. And of course, he's observing the city, like Franz. He's wandering around and seeing all of this, and he's disturbed by what he sees, and we'll get some passages from that. But this general animosity toward the urban environment and the sense of disruption and disorientation and confusion that it inflicts on the people who are caught up in it. The economy, especially, just allowing for no stability and no rest at all. And he feels that and observes it and sees the urban world as something that needs to be cured. And very early says, well, I see 1, 2, 3 measures that will be necessary to deal with this problem. So this voice of clear, simple responses to difficult, confusing questions, right, comes out even in his description of his experiences as a teenager, really, early 20s, up to his early 20s in the city. Now, he leaves Vienna a couple of times and goes up to Munich. And the first time that he does that was to dodge the draft. He doesn't want to get drafted. He's a draft dodger. Which doesn't seem that consistent with his whole military thing. But on the other hand, that's another thing where he can't quite go nya nya nya, because his point was he didn't want to be drafted into the Austrian army because he saw that as a bastardized thing. I mean, he was German and he wasn't going to, he didn't want to be part of this Austrian thing. So we can't quite nail him for that, but he's in Munich in 1914 when the First World War breaks out. And I'll show you the picture. I think you've already probably noticed it back there, but he was in the crowd in 1914 when the mobilization was announced in the main plaza of Munich, and you can see him standing there. And he says, this was the most exhilarating, exciting time in my life. So like so many people, he was caught up in that war enthusiasm, and it provided him with structure going into the battle. Like Dietrich says, it feels good to be part of a larger institution. And he totally subsumed his personality into the military and thrived there. And hence, now the next phase in his experience. He was in the army and on the front for 4 years. And he was given 5 military awards, and he was wounded twice. So he served honorably and was utterly committed as a German soldier, and had found his niche there, and certainly probably saw that was going to be his career, right, in the military. And now another thing that we've talked a little bit about, because Paul is part of it, and we've talked about it, is how it influenced the stillbirth of the Weimar Republic. But he's there right through to this last offensive of 1918. And you're going to get some description of his experience there and the sense of exhilaration when they did actually break out after 4 years of trench warfare, right? And as they're starting to break out, he's gassed and goes into a field hospital and is blinded. And in that hospital, he learns that the offensive has petered out, and that revolutionary forces have arisen in the Navy and back in Berlin, and that peace was being negotiated. Right? So that this is the source of that whole despair, contracted into this myth of having been stabbed in the back, and Hitler buys into it hook, line, and sinker, and believes it utterly, that this leftist Jewish conspiracy has undermined the final drive toward possible victory. So he claims that that's the moment when he decided that he was going to enter into politics. Now, just to scan this out, because you'll be reading this, it bounces around a little bit, but just to give you the overview, he comes back at the end of the war, and his troop returns to Munich, the Munich area. Now, his intention is to stay with the army, and he's going to continue to work with the army after his service. And what he is assigned to do is essentially act as a political intelligence. And he's assigned to observe all these splinter parties that are running around in Munich. And he's assigned the duty of keeping an eye on this group of DAP, the German Workers' Party, which was just a small tool and die workers' party. So he was sent to that party to observe. Now, at the same time, he's also training as a kind of a instructor for troops who are about to be released. And they're given a session, maybe a series of talks, some lectures about how they should remain true to the military and to the German nation and to the values and principles and institutions for which they had fought in the war. And he becomes an instructor in this program. And that's where he does his first public speaking and discovers that he's fairly good at it. So those two things are happening at the same time. He's observing the party, and he's giving these sessions. And what happens then is the coalescence of the two. The party organizers ask him not just to watch them, but to join them, and he decides to do so. And then he draws upon the experience that he's getting in the military running these sessions, becomes more and more involved and vociferous at the meetings and the rallies, and then begins the move to take control of the party himself through a process of reform, bringing to bear his political views, but more importantly, his aesthetic capacity as a designer, as an architect, as an artist, to ramp up the propagandistic capacity of this group. Right. So he's the one that starts to design, organize, structure the rallies. He's the one that sits down and designs their uniforms. He's the one that designs their new flag and so forth. And all the time he's competing with the other members of the party who have already been around for a while, but gradually emerges as the most popular speaker among them. And after a few months or maybe a year or so, is able to seize control within the party itself and has himself named the Führer of that little party, which numbers in the hundreds at that time. Yeah? Is it time?
Yeah.
Okay. So that gets us up to about halfway into the story of and about as much as I think we'll be able to, you know, you'll be able to look through. But that's the background that he's telling you over the top. And what we'll be doing is looking for the principal themes by which he provided, you know, clear articulation of particular problems and a clear prescription for solutions to those problems in the whole Weimar world. All right, the moment you've all been waiting for. Reading Mein Kampf. Something probably most Germans didn't do. There's some debate about that. They all had to buy it, of course, and it was a recommended wedding gift. More than recommended. It was the wedding gift, in fact. They even had a special edition put out called the Wedding Edition. Yeah. So, I mean, there is this notion of it being the sacred text of the movement, but whether anybody actually cracked it is probably something we'll never be able to verify. officially, yes, but when you're in a totalitarian society, there are ways to work around these things. But the value that it has for us is that it's probably as close as you're going to get to really hearing Hitler's voice. Now, there are films of the certain rallies and some extended excerpts of his speeches, but there aren't that many. And the actual experience of going to one of the beer halls in the early days, we can talk a little bit more about that as we get going, or going to one of the larger, what would we call them, auditoriums, concert halls, we'd probably call them, where they moved after the early days, or being in one of those stadiums. But really the former, because that's where people said the act of being present in front of this guy in a dense hall and hearing him go through his act was moving. Not even people who didn't like what he was saying, even people didn't agree with him, opponents, they had to admit that there was something exciting. I'm looking for something more of a, but I want to go too far, about watching this. These things would go on for 2 and 3 hours. I mean, can you imagine what someone speaking monotone for 2.5 hours? And sitting through it? And paying to do so? I mean, I can get away with saying that's just incredible in a 50-minute class, but in these classes, I guess that doesn't quite hold water. Well, I'm not against it. I'm not against it. You bring in whatever it is you need to get through.
Right.
And you don't even have to share. Just don't tell them. Right? And I'll just give you a little. He had arranged things, part of his design, his approach to things. He was, he had a sense for design. There's no doubt about it, and the whole movement did. If you look at some of the posters and forget what you're looking at, they're pretty cool. They really knew how to have visual impact. Some of these campaign posters from 30, 32. When they were still having to campaign and compete with others. Images of Hitler's face coming out of this black, just says "Yeah" at the bottom. I mean, it's well designed, and many have, without telling you, but many advertising agencies have looked at those things and seen that there's potency there. And that was not just Hitler. I mean, he wasn't doing all the posters as well, but he set a standard of design, and in the effort to move toward the Führer, there were some very good graphic artists doing their thing out there. But in terms of constructing these rituals, what emerges out of the beer halls and out of these smaller halls and culminate in the rallies at Nuremberg, which I think we'll look at some more of that, but after we go through Mein Kampf. I was going to start with that, but we'll move to that. It'll make more sense, I think. It'll be deeper if we do that first. Was a process which, as I said in the very first lecture introduction, had components of the Baroque Catholic Church, without doubt, all that sacred ritual there. And was stirring to see these masses of SA men in their formation, and bringing in those seas of flags and hearing those cannon, and then especially that call and response process where the leader, whether it be Hitler or whoever else is addressing that crowd, would say certain phrases and they knew exactly what to say in response. And you'd have this chanting going on back and forth. Very moving. So you had that, and if it works on a massive scale of 300,000 people out in an airfield, you can imagine how it works in a hall of 5,000. Right? Intense, with flames and music and marching and call and response and all of that. I mean, that's the seed of it. It was a hell of a show. And they knew that, and that's what they worked at. Now, this is subsequent to Mein Kampf, but they attempt to campaign in the cities, and they did not do well at that. This is between 1925 and 1929. They're trying to figure it out, and they're working very hard at it. But they would rent the beer hall, which is like renting a room in a convention center. It's not just, that's why you rent beer halls, because they have rooms for business groups to get together. It's like renting a suite at the Radisson for your convention. That's the equivalent. It sounds funny, beer hall putsch, and they're in the beer halls. And yes, they're swilling beer, but they're up in some rooms that are just for them. They've rented those rooms for the night. The communists rent them the next night, and the socialists rent them the next night, and then some business group might rent them on Friday, right? That's why they're in the beer halls. It's sort of the equivalent there. They would rent those halls, or they would rent larger facilities in the city, but they're in competition with the communists and with the socialists and with other parties at the time, and they didn't do that well. But then they decided to shift to what's known as the rural plan. This was Goebbels' idea. And they started hitting the small towns. And instead of spreading out their forces, their resources, they decided to come into a certain number of small towns with everything they had. Okay. And they would drum this up for a week or 2 weeks. Signs would start to show up. They'd start driving through with their trucks and do, minor demonstrations on the streets. Hitler's coming. Hitler's coming next Friday, right? So they do this preparation for the main event. And then that day would come, and they'd have a rally downtown, and they'd march out to where the hall would be, and, they'd build all this up. And then they'd get people in there, and it was a show. It was a show. People came for the show. And you're in some small town, some small farming town, this is a pretty cool thing. You've got all these red flags, and you've got these songs that are associated with them, and the rituals, and so on and so forth. So people just come because they're curious. And they actually pay. They pay to come. It's a price, they pay an admission price at the door to get in. So it's self-financing, something, Goebbels came up with. And then there'd be all the build-up and so on and so forth. And invariably, Hitler would be late. Oh, he's coming. He's coming, but, he's stuck in traffic up there. He's coming down. Or when they shift this to airplanes, he's flying around, which had never been done before. It was amazing. It was Hitler's, flying tour. You could get the T-shirts. I mean, literally, they were selling stuff. They didn't have T-shirts, but they're selling bric-a-brac, Hitler bric-a-brac. So they're also financing things that way. It was just like going to a rock concert. That's what it was like. It was like going, and of course the band that you want to see is going to be late. That's part of the design. They're always going to be late. Bob Dylan's going to stumble out there. Well, he's going to stumble out there 2.5 hours late and play for 20 minutes. Well, Hitler could pull that off too, because and by the time he got in there, people were just ready. Let's do it. My God, we've been getting ready for this all along. And then he would come out, and he wouldn't say anything. just sort of sit there for a while. And then he would speak in almost a whisper. That's how it would start. And, you know, so the whole place has to just, you know, stop to listen to what he has. And he'd start talking very dry, you know, nothing very important, anything like that. And then this would build up, and it would build up, and it would build up. And by, you know, an hour in, or an hour and a half in, or 2 hours in, it would peak where he's just going crazy. Right? So he'd take you from this very, you know, silent. And that's where, for those of us who are interested in the cultural aspect and the presentation, I believe, based on descriptions, because you can't prove this, but based on descriptions, this is where Wagner influences him, right? Because he's taking this long trajectory over a couple of hours to present you this material, and there's this build-up, like the beginning of the ring cycle. It's just an E flat, like a whisper, and it builds and builds and builds and builds and builds and builds. And by the time you got to those explosions at the end, I mean, people were just completely caught up. It was very impressive. And he'd be in paroxysm, his eyeballs be bursting out of his head, and he'd be sweating and screaming, and you know, this taut stuff would be coming out. But it looks crazy if you're not there. But if you sat there and experienced this whole thing, that whole evening, right, with all the buildup, or maybe from the morning on, you know, it was ecstatic just to see that peak out. So we can't recreate it, but we do know that also, like Wagner, there was a tremendous amount of repetition. Okay. Now, we talked a little bit about it before, but the stump speech. Okay. The stump speech. Reagan had a stump speech. Obama had a stump speech. If you remember, John Edwards just did his stump speech over and over and over again and kind of wore it out 4 years ago. And it was a good stump speech, but you know, you just kept hearing about those same two people out there, whatever his story was, and he kept telling that. Well, Hitler had his stump speech, and really Hitler's stump speech did not change for 20 years. I mean, it was the same stump speech over and over and over again. Of course, for different audiences, he would highlight different aspects of it. Right? But you got the stump speech. That's what this is. I mean, he dictated this in jail. I'll tell you a little bit about that if you don't know already. Off the top of his head, you know, he just blurted this out in a few weeks. And there are all sorts of rumors about how Winifred Wagner provided him with the paper to write Mein Kampf while he was in jail in the Landsberg prison. Well, then people go, but wait a minute, he didn't write it on paper. He dictated it. You know, so there's kind of a disconnect there. But the fact is, he's just blurting out the stuff he'd been saying in the beer halls all the time. So yeah, there's a certain narrative here. But when he shifts into rant about the Jews and culture, or rant about social democrats and so on and so forth, you're getting what he was saying in these speeches, more or less. So that's what I mean when I say this is about as close as you can get to it. Right? Because you're really getting it straight from him. This is what this kind of stuff that he was saying in these things. You don't get the drama, right? But you, through this text, you're as close as you can get to it, I would say, in translation, right? And you sort of have to put it into that framework, or imagine what it would have been like to have him spouting all of this out. But the language here, this is the language that's sold. This is the language of the stump speech. So let me just say a couple things about the events that lead up to this, and then maybe ask if you have any questions about the early days. Then we'll go through the text and highlight some of the major themes and draw out the main planks in the stump speech. And then we'll move to how they seize power a little bit of political history, and move to the First World War and the Holocaust and so on after that, next time. I think I got us up to the point where he's engaged with this party. And he has shifted from observing it as a kind of political intelligence agent, and at the same time that he was doing this educational, patriotic educational program for the army, as people were released. And he has decided to renovate this party. Now, it takes a little while. It takes weeks, months, a year or so for him to develop enough authority within that party to make the changes that he wants to. So it's a bit of an oversimplification. But, you know, he's very impressive, and he becomes their most popular speaker. That's the basis of his influence. He can sell tickets. He can sell tickets in these beer halls, and people will come and listen to him. And he's training himself to be a better speaker, by the way. He's hiring at least one actor to show him how to move his hand and, you know, and present himself on stage. And he's standing in front of mirrors and looking at different outfits and, you know, really conscious of his image. You see him in all kinds of outfits in the early days. Not quite as crazy as Wilhelm II, but Irish traditional garb, tuxedos, just business suits, military, what Nazi outfits. I mean, they're not part of the military, but they're sort of a military outfit that he designed, with the leather straps across the front and the brown outfit and the boots and the cap. He actually designed that. He did a little, you know, fashion work there. So it's all very, very consciously constructed. And then he designs the flag. He draws the swastika from right-wing groups who are using it already. They weren't unique in using the swastika. You can see the swastika all over in the streets of Munich and Berlin during that time. It was a symbol that these folkish movements that we already heard about back before the war, Heinrich Mann had incorporated, and the reason nobody can tell you exactly what the swastika means, even within the German Nazi context, is because it meant a lot of different things. Different groups said different things about it, right? But it had been associated with let's say, you know, Aryan folkish movements, anti-Semitic groups, among others, right, by the time he picked it off. You'll see, if you look at some of these rogue military groups that are running around in the streets of Berlin and streets of Munich, called Freikorps, those who killed, for instance, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. Some of the photographs of them, they've hand-painted swastikas onto their military helmets. They've kept their helmets from the army, and you can see swastikas painted on them. Now, they're not Nazis yet. Nazis, you know, they're not associated with the party, but they have that. So, you know, it's around, and he borrows it. And it's a universal symbol that exists in all sorts of native indigenous cultures globally. So, you know, if you're walking around in Latin America somewhere, and you go out and explore some ancient temples, and you see the swastika, no, the Nazis hadn't been there. You know, those were the Aztecs, and they had swastikas as well. It throws you, because it just shows you how powerful a symbol is, right? A visual symbol. And, you know, useful that was in the long run. Now, as far as political strategy goes, this was just one lunatic right-wing group among dozens functioning just in Munich at that time. Okay? And they generally had the stab in the back theory going about the First World War. We should have won that war. We were undermined from behind. Some would have simply emphasized the leftist political aspect of it. Some included the Jewish, and some emphasized the Jewish. Right? They all have those basic elements. The Versailles Treaty was unjust. We shouldn't have had to sign that war guilt clause. And then a general incorporation of those romantic, folkish notions that the city is a place of sin and iniquity, and we need to, you know, revive German tradition, the woods, the mountains, the sky, the sun, and so on. Many of these groups come out of sun-worshipping orientation, and nudism was part of that. Yeah, the body worship, which is still alive in Munich, by the way. I don't know if how many of you have visited Munich? Anybody? Okay. Well, if you go out after you've stumbled around in the beer hall, in the Hofbräuhaus, which is, you know, something to do. If you're going to sit around, yeah. I've been there, and I've had much more than my share. I've been overserved at the Hofbräuhaus. And then you go, but if you continue, back from there, you'll run into the Englische Garten, and there is a beautiful park with this incredible stream that runs through it. It's been redirected from the Isar River, which runs down from the Alps. So there's this crystal pure alpine water that runs through there. And along that in the summer, there's a whole section of naked sunbathing, still. Which sounds really great when you're 16 and then you go there and it's basically a bunch of 35-year-old men sitting around there. But, I mean, it's fine if you're a 35-year-old man, not that there's anything wrong with it. But the fringes of it are a little bit more interesting if you're 16, 17 years old. But that nudism, that sun worship, and so on, some of that aspect of the folkish tradition was also part of any number of these groups. And by the way, it's that stuff that Hitler, we won't go into that, but Hitler criticizes all of that. He says, you know, that's so backward looking, you know, we're doing something different here. Right? A lot of that gets incorporated into Nazism. Himmler being the chief lunatic of them all. But Hitler himself is not that into it, surprisingly. He's into his issues and his plan and his vision, and he's very practical in that sense. Himmler's the one who's, you know, has Indiana Jones is running around, German Indiana Jones is running around in Nepal looking for Aryan knives to collect for him. I mean, that's Himmler's stuff. And so some of that stuff gets incorporated into Nazism, but Hitler doesn't see that as primary. He's very practical in that sense. So this group is bouncing around with all these others. And then there are left-wing, obviously the communists are around, the socialists are around, and then a wide spectrum of many parties, as many newspapers as are mentioned in Berlin-Alexanderplatz, of other groups that are struggling for attention, for money, for the ability to use the beer halls for their meetings, and so on and so forth. And Hitler is kind of a character within that world. He's known as a popular speaker within that world, not outside of it, but within that world. People pay attention in Bavaria to his rise. They know that there's a sex scandal, which people don't pay that much attention to now. But I mean, he's involved with a young cousin of his, and she ends up, I believe, dead in his apartment. Suicide. But they're able to keep him separate from it. But that's a story that's not told. But he survives a sex scandal and suicide during this period. The decision is, how are these small splinter groups going to have any impact? Now, all this is going on at the worst period of economic downturn resulting from the inflationary practices, which Orlo, again, can do a better job of explaining than I can, but Germany's inability to pay for the reparations that are owed to France, according to the Versailles Treaty, trigger the occupation of the Ruhr Valley, which is the most important industrial center in the German economy. So you have French troops in the Ruhr during at one point in 1923. And this is when people are, I mean, it's, I don't know what, 90 million marks to buy a loaf of bread. Okay? It's, the inflation is unbelievable. It's, you know, it's 50 million marks to buy a postage stamp. There are all sorts of anecdotes, but one is that people wanted to be paid, you know, twice a day so that they could run to the bank and buy what they could at noon, because they wouldn't be able to pay for it, you know, 2 hours later. The inflation was so rampant. And again, I could read through a bunch of statistics, but that's what's going on during this period. If you see the photographs of people wheeling, you know, whole wheelbarrows full of money to buy an apple, you know, that sort of thing. That's what's going on in 1923. So you've got foreign forces on German territory taking resources away from the Ruhr Valley, the Ruhr territory, and you've got this rampant inflation. And this is the crisis that these groups think will give them an opportunity. The Ruhr crisis and the inflation of 1923. So they arrange to band together a number of these right-wing folkish groups. And they are going to attempt what Mussolini had attempted in Italy, which was to march on Rome. What they want to do is seize power in Bavaria and then march on Berlin. That's the plan. And they think it's possible because they have a backing of a former war hero, General Ludendorff, who's a whack job. But they've got him, they think. And the plan is to gather and march on City Hall in Munich, seize power there, and then move forward. And they're supposed to have weapons drawn away from the army by Ludendorff. And the night before this is all supposed to take place, Ludendorff reneges on the arms. They don't have the guns. And so they meet in one of these beer halls across the river, another one over there, not the... most of them say, well, we can't do it. We can't go. We can't do this. And Hitler goes ballistic. He just goes crazy. This is notorious. It's screaming fit. And he grabs a pistol and he jumps up on one of these beer hall tables and he shoots it into the ceiling. You know, God damn it, we're going to go. So they go the next day. And they're mowed down. They're stopped. It was a fiasco. Hitler somehow survived. 16 were shot. These are the martyrs. You get the blood flag from that event. And Hitler is eventually arrested and put on trial for this. Well, here's where the issue which flittered by in terms of there, we can't get no justice in Franz Bieberkopf, and I use that quote to talk about the fact, and Orlow goes into greater detail about the residual conservatism of the justice system. If this had been a leftist movement, everybody arrested would probably have been executed. Probably. They've committed high treason. Their goal was to overthrow the government. And that was, they didn't deny it at all. That was patent. It wasn't debatable. Hitler was not a citizen of Germany. Send him back to Austria instantly. At least he should have been exiled. But the judge allowed Hitler to use the trial as a soapbox and let him just stand there and do his speeches and do his rants and so on and so forth, and then commended him for his fatherlandish attitudes, spirit, and gave him the lightest possible sentence, and with time for time served so far, and then they gave him a parole. And they put him in this low security Schlossgefängnis, which was a nice apartment with a good view in a nice castle. And he had so many visitors that he had to tell the guards to stop letting the visitors come because they were keeping him from writing Mein Kampf. But the big shift that's taking place here is the shift from this literal seizure of power through violent means on the Mussolini model to, well, that didn't work, and we are going to have to do things legally from now on. We're going to have to build a popular base, and we're going to have to use propaganda techniques that we learned about in the war and that we began to use in these in the Munich Bavarian context. But we're going to have to do that on a broader scale. Now.
This really doesn't matter, but I was just going to ask if that was a real figure, that it was 90 million marks.
No. Okay. But it's not that far off the mark.
Okay.
I can find some source that has the real numbers for you. They're crazy. They don't make any sense. You can't even see how that would begin to work. Right, bills with lots of zeros on them, for a candy bar. So, this was the I guess you could call it the Mussolini plan, and then subsequent to this, all of the lessons learned through that failure are applied in the process of attempting from roughly 1925. They briefly outlawed the party, but it was reinstated within months. The newspaper was shut down for about a year, and then it was allowed to continue after that. So they were really slapped on the wrist for what they had attempted. And I'm getting ahead of the book and the story, but it takes 4 years. They call them the years of struggle. Years of struggle for them, because they're nothing up through 1928. They're just a sputtering organization trying to get back on their feet after a fiasco in 1923. And all that changes with the economy in 1929-1930. But we'll deal with that as we go. So this is the background to the writing of this. He's not writing with reference to everything that takes place subsequently. He's only writing with reference to his experiences in Vienna, First World War, and those early years up till 1923, the first three or so years of his political activity. Now, the reason that that's significant is one of the pivotal issues of the study of National Socialism. Did Hitler, at this early juncture, lay out a blueprint for everything that was going to take place subsequently? This is the intentionalist versus the contingency analysis or interpretation of the Nazi movement. The intentionalists say, he laid it out. It's all there. He says it. And including extermination of political enemies and extermination of the Jewish problem. Others say, how can he possibly have had that kind of, cockiness, that he would have been laying this out as a clear plan of action. When he's, you know, he's sitting in jail, the party at that point is banned. The newspaper's banned. Their finances are gone. They're, you know, it's at a zero hour for him. So it's unreasonable to think that he really thought he was going to be able to apply all those things at that time. Okay. I mean, I'm oversimplifying as usual. But those are the two extreme views of the intentionalist versus the contingency or whatever another term for that. But the notion that he had these general principles in mind, but the application of them could only take place on a contingent basis as things unfold over time. You know, when you try to explain it to somebody, you kind of say, well, does it really matter? I mean, that's what happened. Does it really matter that whether Hitler intended to do it and had a clear plan for it or did it on a contingency basis? And I'm not sure I can answer that question, but a lot of historians have argued and careers have been made and destroyed on the basis of whether or not you're an intentionalist or a contingency. It's sort of like the issue that I raised last time. Does it matter that Hitler had Jewish blood? What are we going to do? Say, oh, you see, you were wrong? I mean, right. But anyway, just so you know, I mean, a lot of books and articles and careers are centered on what is said in Mein Kampf, specifically. Because that's our closest record we have to what he was saying in these beer halls and so on. And just to set that issue aside, he was implying extermination of national enemies in 1920. There are records of speeches in which that kind of language is present. But we've already read that there were indications of that before the First World War. And I can tell you that, you know, Wagner and Hester Stewart Chamberlain and some of these other folkish people were using language like that in 1880, 1875. So, you know, it's in the air, and Hitler's tapping into that. It really isn't anything new. It may be new to somebody who's coming in from a planet and looks down and says, boy, these Germans are really crazy, they're talking about Jews like that. But within a subset of German culture, we know that that's not an uncommon thought. You know, that's not an uncommon framework with which to view the world as they saw it. They call it a worldview. Our worldview puts this racial problem and Jewish problem in the center. The Nazi or the communist worldview puts the economy and class relations and the bourgeoisie in the center. That's the clash between the two. But once you construct your worldview around that, the rest of it unfolds. But those elements were around. So I think that's important to recognize that Hitler was not inventing this stuff. And we know it. Yes?
I was going to say, didn't he recognize the hypocrisy of his and say that there was a money that he wanted to, like, extirpate political enemies or whatever, but that he was going
to do it back from them? That's kind of a paradox. Or did he not see it that way? Well, I think what you have to get used to in dealing with Hitler studies like this is, is Hitler a hypocrite? Well, let's add that to his problems. Yeah, right. Is it paradoxical? Yeah. There are all sorts of paradoxes. There are all sorts of hypocritical things. Is it worse than other politicians who are making promises to various groups and emphasizing certain things at certain times and other things at other times? Well, yes, it's worse. Right, but it's not all that different. Yeah. So I would caution you against reading through and arguing with Hitler. Right? You're not going to win the argument because there are so many inconsistencies and hypocrisies and so on, on one hand. And, I mean, he did what he did. It's done. Right? So we look at it to, you know, not to, let's say, duel with Hitler, but to make sure that we don't fall for the same kind of language or manipulation of symbols or manipulation of emotions that he was so effective at doing, I think. And also to get a sense of these themes and how powerful they were at that time, hypocritical or not. To go through and see how he uses the war, the language of the war, how he uses the language of the city as a problem, how he uses the issues of the Jewish threat and incorporates sexual language and so on and so forth, and that these become the hot button, what we call the hot button issues out there, right? And that those have powerful emotional impact that can distract people from the real issues, frankly. And this is what he was so good at. Right? Now, he made those central issues. Was Hitler an anti-Semite? Hitler was an anti-Semite. Did Hitler know how anti-Semitism could be used as a political weapon? Yes, he knew he knew that anti-Semitism could be used as a political weapon. Is he conscious of the way he's using anti-Semitism in its hypocritical, utilitarian way? Yes, he is. Does he seem to actually know that he's heaping a big lie about Jewish influence on German society and the need to eradicate it because that's a great way to focus the minds of the German population and gain their support because it provides a very simple, clear view of things? Yes, he knows that. Does he believe that big lie? Yes, he believes it. There's your real core hypocrisy or paradox. Because he's so articulate about the fact that he's lying, and he knows the impact of that. But he believes, there's no question that he believes it. Right? Because it goes right to the end. It goes to the last minutes. He never lets up and goes, you know, the Jews aren't that bad. I just, you know, I can let off of that, you know, 5 minutes before I shoot myself. No, he never relents in that. So I think that's the trick. For me, that's the trickiest paradox, is that he could be so conscious of the utilitarian aspect of his propaganda and yet believe it. And that's true of most of them who took the pill, I would say. And probably similarly at play in any worldview that offers a pill like that, whether it's the Jews or the Arabs or the whatever you're going to decide it, are the heathens that need to be eradicated. Right? Okay.